Hello, and welcome to the Service Contractor's Business Tape CD of the Month. This monthly cassette CD series represents yet another step in accomplishing Granding Associates' vision of helping the service contractor come to a place of maturity and profitability. Each month, a different national speaker from throughout the service and trades industry shares dozens of cost-reducing, profit-increasing ideas to help you become a more profitable company. This month's speaker is an old friend to most of our listeners. Roger Dawson is the master of negotiating, and he's provided many wonderful presentations in the past. This month, Roger is going to talk about tactics and counter-tactics of negotiating. As always, I'm sure you're going to love Roger's presentation.
In this session, we'll be talking about some of the specific power negotiating gambits that contractors can use during the negotiating process to get what they want. Now, some of these may seem awfully ruthless to you. You may say, where on earth did this guy come from? I bet he's the kind of guy who would train homing pigeons and then move. In fact, I was doing a seminar in St. Louis one time, and I was standing in the back of the room waiting to be introduced when a man in front of me, who didn't realize I was behind him, said to his friend, have you heard this next speaker? This guy could get the gold right out of your teeth. Of course, I had to correct him, because that's not negotiating, that's stealing. Now, when you get the gold out of their teeth and they thank you for it, that's power negotiating. As a contractor, you know that you live in a rough-and-tumble world where everyone has enormous pressures on them to squeeze out that last dollar of profit. The developer has to bid the job tight in order to get it in the first place. Then the general has to sharpen his pencil to beat the competition. By the time the job gets let to the sub, it's not unusual to find everybody feeling that they don't have any slack left in the bid at all. So every little change order has to be fiercely negotiated in order for anyone to maintain their profit margins. And a big part of power negotiating for contractors becomes not what can I get the other guy to do for me, but how can I stop them doing what they're doing to me right now? So bear in mind that even if you never use some of these gambits because you don't feel comfortable with them, you still need to know about them. Because whether you realize it or not, they're being used against you all the time. And a typical reaction from what we'll cover during these next four sessions is, I finally figured out what they did to me. Now I understand why I didn't get that bid accepted. Now I understand how they got me to go along with 10% retainage. Now I understand why I paid more for that equipment than I should have done. Now I know how that general got me to agree to be paid when he got paid. So with that in mind, let's talk about power negotiating for contractors. First of all, the principle of nibbling. Unfortunately, that's not as exciting as it sounds. The principle of nibbling says that you can get a little bit more even after everything has been agreed to. Car dealers understand this, don't they? Car dealers know that when they can get you onto the lot, there's kind of a psychological resistance that is built up to the purchase. If they can get you to the point where you're thinking, yes, I'm going to buy a car, yes, I'm going to buy it here, which they do by closing you on any make and model of car, even a stripped-down model that carries a little profit for them, then they can get you into the closing room and start adding on all the other little extras that really build the profit into the car. So the principle of nibbling tells you that you don't necessarily ask for everything up front. Some things are more easily accomplished through a nibble later on in the negotiations. Children are brilliant nibblers, aren't they? If you have teenage children at home, you know that they don't have to take any courses on power negotiating. But you have to, just to stand a chance of surviving the whole process of bringing them up, because they're naturally brilliant negotiators. My daughter Julia, when she graduated from high school, wanted to get a really nice high school graduation gift from me. She had three things on her hidden agenda. Number one, she wanted a five-week trip to Europe. Number two, she wanted $1,200 in spending money. Number three, she wanted a new set of luggage. She was smart enough not to ask for everything up front. She was a good enough negotiator to first close me on the trip, then come back a few weeks later and show me in writing, and I'll stress the importance of the in writing part later, show me in writing that the recommended spending money was $1,200 and got me to commit to that. And then right at the last minute, she came to me and she said, Dad, you wouldn't want me going to Europe with that radio set of luggage, would you? All the kids will be there with new luggage. And she got that too. Had she asked for everything up front, I would have negotiated out the luggage and negotiated down the spending money. What's happening here is that the mind always works to reinforce decisions that it has just made. Power negotiators know how this works and use it to add that little extra profit to the job. That little extra profit that, for contractors, can make the difference between profit and loss. Why is nibbling such an effective technique? A couple of psychologists did a study to find out exactly what was going on here, and they did it, of all places, up at a racetrack in Canada. They studied the attitudes of people immediately before they placed a bet and again immediately after they placed the bet. What they found out was that before they placed a bet, people were very uptight, unsure, and anxious about what they were about to do. Now, I want you to relate this to a general contractor who is not sure you're the right subcontractor for the job, or you're the general and the developer is still not completely sold on you. The other side is very uptight, unsure about the decision that they're about to make. At the racetrack, they found out that once the people had made the decision to go ahead and had placed the bet, all of a sudden they felt very, very good about what they'd just done, and even had a tendency to want to double the bet before the race started. If you're a gambler, you've had that sensation, haven't you? Watch them at the roulette tables in Atlantic City or Vegas. The bets are placed. The ball is spun. At the very last moment, people are pushing out additional bets. The mind always works to reinforce decisions that it had made earlier. I spoke to the Philadelphia branch of the National Electrical Contractors at about the time that the Pennsylvania lottery prize was $50 million. To illustrate how people's minds work to reinforce the decisions that they made, I tried to buy a lottery ticket from somebody in the audience. Do you think they would sell me one? No, not even for 50 times the purchase price. I'm sure that before they bought that ticket, they were uptight and anxious about betting money on a 100 million to one shot. But having made the decision, they weren't about to change their minds. The mind works to reinforce decisions that it has made earlier. So one rule for power negotiators is that you don't necessarily ask for everything up front. You wait for a moment of agreement in the negotiations and then go back and nibble for a little bit extra. You might think of the power negotiating process as pushing a ball uphill, a large rubber ball that's much bigger than you, and you're forcing it up to the top of the hill. The top of the hill is the moment of first agreement in the negotiations. Once that point is reached, then the ball moves easily down the other side of the hill. So timing is very, very critical. You see, after the initial agreement has been made, people feel good. They feel a sense of relief that the tension and stress is over. Their mind is working to reinforce the decision that they made earlier, and they're more receptive to any additional suggestions you may have. It's time for the second effort. Vince Lombardi always used to talk about the second effort, didn't he? He'd show football clips of receivers who almost caught the ball, but it just slipped through their fingers. But instead of giving up, they made the second effort. They dove and caught the ball before it hit the ground. Well, the running back, where the defense almost got their hands on him, but he wriggled free anyway and made the touchdown. And Lombardi used to say that everyone makes the first effort. You wouldn't be a football player if you weren't in there making the first effort. You wouldn't be a contractor if you weren't making the first effort to get the job, or to get that owner to upgrade to the best quality, or making the first effort to get that general to pay full bore for that change order. But Vince Lombardi always pointed out that the difference between the ones who are good at what they do and the superstars in the business are the ones who make the second effort. And the second effort works because of the principle of nibbling. So always go back at the end for that second effort. Perhaps you're the contractor on a new hotel project and you're trying to convince the owner that he should go with expensive Italian marble in the entryway. But he's balking at that kind of expense. You back off, but come back and nibble for it before you leave. After you've reached agreement on all the other points, you say, "Could we take another look at the Italian marble for the entryway? With this kind of high-class project, I really think it's going to make all the difference in the world to the look of the project." And you've got a good chance of them saying to you, "Well, all right, if you think it's that important, let's go ahead." So you always go back at the end to make a second effort on something that you couldn't get them to go along with earlier. But on the other hand, look out for people nibbling on you. There's a point in the negotiation where you're very, very vulnerable, and that point is when you think the negotiations are all over. I bet you've been the victim of a nibble at one time or another. You've been selling a surplus truck to someone. You're finally feeling good because you found the buyer. Pressure and the tension of the negotiations has drained away. They're sitting in your office writing out the check. And just as they're about to sign their name, they look up and say, "That does include a full tank of gas, doesn't it?" You're at your most vulnerable point then in the negotiations, for two reasons. Number one, you've just made a sale and you're feeling good. And when you feel good, you tend to give things away that you otherwise wouldn't. And number two, you're thinking, "Oh no, I thought this was all resolved. I don't want to have to take a chance on going back to the beginning and renegotiating the whole thing. Perhaps I'm better off just giving in on this little point." So you're at your most vulnerable just after the decision has been made. Look out for people nibbling on you. You're a sub and you're shaking hands with the general, thinking that everything's agreed. And at the very last minute, he says to you, "Oh, by the way, you do understand that you get paid when I get paid, don't you?" You're at your most vulnerable point then. Or you're the general and the developer is saying to you, "Oh, by the way, you will take care of any plan review changes, won't you?" Look out for people nibbling on you. Now, if you have salespeople selling the jobs for you, they're not going to come back to you and say, "Boy, was that guy a good negotiator. He slid that nibble in on me, and before I even knew what he'd done, I'd agreed to take care of any plan review changes." No! He's going to come back to you and say, "I got the job, but I had to promise that we'd take care of any plan review changes." The counter tactic to the nibble is to gently make the other person feel cheap. You've got to be very careful about the way you do this, because obviously you're at a sensitive point in the negotiation. So you smile sweetly and you say, "Oh, come on, you negotiated a fantastic price on the job. Don't make me wait for my money too. Fair enough." And that's the counter tactic to the nibble when it's used against you. Be sure that you do it with a big grin on your face so they don't take it too seriously. So consider this when you go into negotiations. Are there some elements that are better off broached as a nibble after the initial agreement has been made? Do you have a plan to make a second effort on anything to which you couldn't get them to agree the first time around? And are you prepared for the possibility of them nibbling on you at the last moment? So always take into account the possibility of being able to nibble. Timing is very critical. Catching the other person when they feel good because they think the negotiations are all over. On the other hand, looking out for the nibble when you're feeling good. At that point, you're very vulnerable and liable to make a concession that half an hour later you'll be thinking, "Why on earth did I do that? I didn't have to do that. We'd agreed on everything already." The next gambit is the hot potato. That's when somebody wants to give you their problem and have you make it your problem. It's like tossing you a hot potato at a barbecue. What hot potatoes do contractors get tossed? Do you ever hear? "We just don't have it in the budget." Whose problem is it that they didn't budget properly? It's theirs, right? Not yours. But they'd like to toss it to you and make it yours. How about, "I can't authorize that"? Whose problem is it that he hasn't developed the trust of the people to whom he reports? It's his, right? Not yours. But he'd like to toss it to you and make it yours. Or have you ever been told, "I need you to move that job up. If you're not here first thing in the morning, this entire project comes to a screeching halt"? Whose scheduling problem is that? His, right? Not yours. But what he'd like to do is toss you his problem and make it yours. What I want to teach you about the hot potato is what the international negotiators would tell you. You see, what I found out from my study of international negotiations and my knowledge of contractor negotiations is that exactly the same things apply. The same rules that apply for the negotiators in Geneva during the arms control talks apply to contractors negotiating a change order, or we're trying to get a sub to move up a job, or negotiating problems with the local union. Exactly the same things apply, and exactly the same responses are appropriate. And here's the response to the hot potato. Test it for validity right away. This is exactly what international negotiators do when the other side tries to give them their problem. They test it for validity right away. Later on is too late. If you work with this problem that they've tossed you, in a short period of time they have now established in their minds that now it's your problem. It becomes too late to test it. My background is as a real estate broker. I used to be president of a 28-office company in Southern California. In real estate, we used to get tossed the hot potato all the time. It was the buyer who would come into one of our offices and say, "We only have $10,000 to put down." And let's assume that to be a very low down payment. The real estate person could possibly work with it, but it's going to be tough. What I would teach the agents to do was to test it for validity right away. "Well, that's fine. We can maybe work with $10,000, but let me ask you this. If I find exactly the right property for you in exactly the right neighborhood, the price and terms are fantastic, your family's going to love it, your kids are going to love having their friends over to play, but it takes $15,000 to get in. Is there any point in showing it to you, or should I just show it to my other buyers?" Now, once in a great while, the person would say, "Look, watch my lips. Don't you understand me? $10,000 is it, not a penny more. I don't care how good a buy it is." But 9 times out of 10, they'd say, "Well, we really didn't want to touch our certificate of deposit, but if it's a really good buy, we might. Or maybe Uncle Joe would help us with the down payment." And immediately you know that the problem they tossed you is not the deal buster that it appeared to be. One of your salespeople may have an owner say to them, "Look, we've got $20 a square yard for carpeting, and that's it." And if they're willing to catch that hot potato, they probably start thinking of cutting prices right away, assuming that what they were told was absolutely gospel. But if they know about testing it for validity up front, they say, "If I could show you a carpet that will give you double the wear and still be good looking 5 years from now and only cost 10% more, you'd want to take a look at it, wouldn't you?" 9 times out of 10, they'll say, "Sure, we'll take a look at it." And you know that the price issue is not the deal buster that it appeared to be. Another way to counter the hot potato of "we don't have it in the budget" is to simply say, "Well, who has the authority to exceed the budget?" Sometimes you'll kick yourself at what happens next. They'll say, "Well, the owner is the only one who could authorize that." And you say, "Well, you want to do it, don't you? Your reputation very often rides not on what the building looks like on opening day, but what it looks like 5 years from now. Why don't you call the owner and see if you can get an okay? Fair enough?" And he'll pick up the phone and call the owner and get an okay. Sometimes it's that simple, but you've got to test for validity right away. I remember doing a seminar for the AGC of Alaska. They put me up at the Anchorage Hilton, and I needed a late checkout. There were two young ladies standing right next to each other at the registration desk, and I said to one of them, "Would you give me a 6 o'clock checkout in my room, please?" And she said, "Well, Mr. Dawson, we could do that for you, but of course we'd have to charge you for an extra half day." I said, "Who would have the authority to waive that charge?" And she pointed to the girl standing next to her, and she said, "She would." The girl standing right next to her. So I leaned over and said to the other girl, "And how would you feel about that?" And she said, "Oh, sure, that would be fine. Go ahead." So look out for people giving you their problems. You've got enough of your own, don't you? It's like the general contractor who was pacing the floor at night. He couldn't sleep and his wife was getting frantic too. "Darling, what's bothering you? Why don't you come to bed?" He said, "Well, we have this huge incremental payment due tomorrow, and the electrical sub's a good friend of ours. I just hate to face him and say that we're not going to have the money to pay him." So the wife picked up the phone and called their friend, the electrical contractor, and said, "That incremental payment we have coming due tomorrow, we don't have the money to pay it." The husband exploded. He said, "What did you do that for? That's what I was afraid of." And she said, "Well, dear, now it's his problem, and you can come to bed." Don't let other people give you their problems. Here's the principle of higher authority. You would think that if you were going out to negotiate something, you would want to have the authority to make a decision. In actual fact, you put yourself in a weakened negotiating position when you do that. Always have a higher authority that you have to check with before you can change your proposal or make a decision. Maybe you'll lose some ego from this, but you'll find it very, very effective. When I was president of the real estate company in California, I used to have salespeople coming in to sell me things all the time. Advertising, photocopy machines, computer equipment, and so on. I would always negotiate the very best price that I possibly could using all of these gambits. Then I would say to them, "This looks fine. I do just have to run it by my board of directors, but I'll get back to you tomorrow with the final okay." The next day I could get back to them and say, boy, are they tough to deal with right now. I felt sure I could sell it to them, but they just won't go along with it unless you can shave another couple of $100 off the price, and I would get it. I'm sure you have mixed emotions about doing that kind of thing, but I'm telling you what you run into out there for your own protection. Mixed emotions, that's when you see your daughter coming home at 2 o'clock in the morning with a Gideon Bible underneath her arm. Higher authority works a lot better when the higher authority is a vague entity like a committee or a board of directors. For example, have you ever actually met a loan committee at a bank? I never have. I'm convinced that whatever the bank, whatever the price of the loan, there's somebody at that bank that can give you a decision without having to go to any committees. But they know that if they said to you, your package is on the president's desk, you'd say, well, let's go talk to him right now. Let's get it resolved. But you can't do that with the vague entity. The use of higher authority is a way of putting pressure on people without confrontation. For example, I own real estate investment property and have tenants to deal with. When I first bought the buildings, I thought that was kind of neat to tell the tenants that I owned the property. It was kind of an ego trip for me. And then when my portfolio got substantial, I realized that it wasn't that much fun anymore, because the tenants assumed that the owner of the property was made of money. And why would it be a problem to replace the carpeting in their unit because of a small cigarette burn, or to replace the drapes? Why would it be a problem if the rent's going to be late this month? He's rich. He's got all that property. Why is he so upset about it? Well, the moment I formed Plaza Properties, my real estate investment company, a lot of my problems went away. I became the president of that company, which is a property management company handling the property for a vague group of investors out there somewhere. Then when they'd say, we've got this hole in the carpet that needs to be replaced, I'd say, quite frankly, I don't think I can get the owners to do that for you just yet. I'll tell you what, you keep the rent coming in on the first of the month, and in about 6 months I'll go to bat for you with the owners. Let me see what I can do for you with them at that time. That's good guy, bad guy. We'll talk about that later. If they would say, Roger, we're not going to have the rent until the 15th of the month, I would say, boy, I know exactly how it goes. Sometimes it can get difficult, but unfortunately on this property, I just don't have any leeway. The owners of this property told me that if the rent's not in on the 5th of the month, I just have to file an eviction notice. So what can we do to get the rent in on time? It's a way of putting pressure on people without confrontation. So always maintain your own resort to higher authority. A counter tactic to higher authority is very critical in case they plan on using it on you. Learn to remove the other person's resort to higher authority before the negotiations start. This is exactly the same thing that the car dealer will do to you when, before he lets you take it for a test drive, he says, let me be sure I understand. If you like this car as much as I know you're going to like it, is there any reason why you wouldn't make a decision today? Or it's the real estate person who, before he puts you into his car to show you property, will say, let me be sure I understand. If we find exactly the right property for you today, is there any reason why you wouldn't make a decision today? Because they know that if they don't remove the resort to higher authority up front, then there's a danger that under the pressure of asking for a decision, the other person will invent a higher authority as a delaying tactic. Such as, gee, I'd love to give you a decision today, but I can't because my father-in-law has to look at the car or the property. Or Uncle Joe is helping us with the down payment and we need to talk to him first. As a contractor, one of the most difficult things that you run into is to take your proposal to the general or to the developer, and they say to you, well, that's fine, and thanks for bringing me the proposal. We'll talk to our committee or our attorney or the owners about it, and if we're interested, we'll get back to you. Where do you go from there? If you're smart enough to counter higher authority before you start, you can remove yourself from that dangerous situation. So before you present the proposal to the general or the developer or the owner, as the case may be, you would say, let me be sure I understand. If this proposal meets all of your needs, now that's as broad as any statement can be, isn't it? The other side is thinking, well, I can wriggle out of that one. If this proposal meets all of your needs, is there any reason why you wouldn't give me a decision today? It's a fairly harmless thing for the other person to say okay to, but look at what you've accomplished if you can get them to say, well, sure, if it meets all of my needs, I'll give you an okay. Look at what you've accomplished. Number one, you've eliminated their right to say, I want to think it over. If they say that, you say, well, let me go over it one more time. There must be something I didn't cover clearly enough because you did indicate to me earlier that you were willing to make a decision today. And secondly, you've eliminated their right to refer it to a higher authority. You've eliminated their right to say, I want my attorney to see it, or the owners, or the committee to take a look at it. But what if you're not able to remove their resort to higher authority? I'm sure there are many situations when you'll say that to people, and they'll come right out and say to you, I'm sorry, but you know that on a project of this size, everything has to get approved by the specifications committee. I'll have to refer it to them for a final decision. Here are the three steps that you take when you're not able to remove their resort to higher authority. Step number one, appeal to their ego. You say with a smile on your face, but they always follow your recommendations, don't they? With some personality styles, that's enough of an appeal to their ego that they'll say, well, I guess you're right. If I like it, you can count on it. But more often than not, they'll say, well, yes, they usually follow my recommendations, but I can't give you a decision until I've taken it to the committee. The second step is to get their commitment that they'll take it to the committee with a positive recommendation. So you say, but you will recommend it to them, won't you? Hopefully, you'll get a response like, yes, it looks like a good proposal to me. I'll go to bat for you with them. This is very important. Get their commitment that they're going to recommend it to the higher authority. I remember that when I first came to this country in 1962, I went to work for a bank in California for a short period of time, and then after 9 months, found that I couldn't stand the excitement of working in the banking industry, so I looked around for something else. I became a management trainee at a department store chain. Before I could go to work for them, I had to be approved by the manager to whom I would be assigned for training. So they sent me up to Napa, California, to interview with the store manager there, Lou Johnson. For whatever reason, the interview didn't go well. I knew that I wasn't going to get the job. And he said to me, Roger, thank you for coming in for the interview. I'll report back to the committee at head office, and you'll be hearing from them. So I said to him, but you will recommend me to them, won't you? That's step number two. Ask for a commitment that they'll go in with a positive recommendation. I saw his mind swinging from one side to the other. He didn't want to recommend me to the committee. On the other hand, he didn't want the confrontation of telling me that he wasn't going to recommend me to the committee. And his mind went from one side to the other for a few minutes, and finally he said, well, yes, I guess I'm willing to give you a try. Immediately revealing that there was no higher authority, there was no committee, he was the one making the decision. So get the person's commitment that they will go in with a positive recommendation. There are only two things that can happen at this point. Either they'll say, yes, they will recommend it to them, or they'll say, no, they won't, because. Either way, you've won. Anytime you can draw out an objection, you should say, hallelujah, because objections are buying signals. That general is not going to object to your price unless he's interested in using you. That owner will not challenge your qualifications to do a job unless you're in the running. Objections are buying signals. We knew in real estate that if we were showing property and the people were oohing and aahing all over the place, if they loved everything about the property, they weren't going to buy. The serious buyers were the ones who were saying, gee, the kitchen's not as big as we like. Hate that wallpaper. We'd probably end up knocking out that wall. Those are the ones that would buy. Think about it. Have you ever in your life done a job where they loved your price up front? Of course not. All serious buyers complain about the price. Your biggest problem is not objections, it's indifference. I would rather they said to you, I wouldn't have you work on this job if you were the last subcontractor in the world, because, than have them say to you, I've been using the same sub for 10 years and he does fine. I'm just not interested in taking the time to talk about making a change. Indifference is your problem, not objections. Objections are buying signals. So when you say to them, you will recommend it to them, won't you? They can either say, yes, they will, or no, they won't. Either way, you've won. Then you can move to step three, which is to go to the qualified subject to close. Now, the subject to close is the same one that your life insurance agent uses on you when he says, quite frankly, I don't know if we can get this much insurance on someone of your age. It would be subject to you passing the physical anyway, so why don't we just write up the paperwork subject to you passing the physical? Now, he knows that if you can fog a mirror during that physical, he can get you that insurance. But it doesn't sound as though you're making as big a decision as you really are. The qualified subject to clause in this particular instance would be, well, look, let's just write up the paperwork subject to the right of your committee to reject the proposal within a 24-hour period for any specifications reason. Now, that's not subject to their acceptance, subject to their right to decline it for a specific reason. If they're going to refer it to an attorney, it would be a legal reason. If they're going to refer it to their CPA, it would be a tax reason, and so on. But try and get it nailed down to a specific reason. What's the counter to the counter tactic? Well, if someone was trying to remove my resort to higher authority like that and said, you do have the authority to make a decision, don't you? I would say in so many words, quite frankly, it depends on what you're asking. There's a point at which I have to go to my board of directors. Let's say that you're a general negotiating a change order with a sub, and they've proposed $35,000. You shake your head and say, wow, that's a lot more than I expected. I'll have to take that to the committee. I'd feel comfortable giving you the go-ahead at $25,000, but anything above that, and we'll just have to hold up the job until I can find out what they have to say. Without creating a confrontation, you've put the sub in a position where he might prefer to go with the $25,000 rather than have the entire job on hold. You may be listening to all this and saying, Roger, I can't use this. I own my own company, and everybody knows it. They know I don't have anybody above me with whom I have to check. Sure, you can use it. I own my own company, too. But there are decisions that I won't make until I've checked with the people to whom I've delegated that area of responsibility. I'll say, sounds good to me, but I have to check with my scheduling people first. Fair enough? One more thing about higher authority. What if you've got somebody trying to force you to a decision before you're ready to make it? Someone's pressuring you to move the start date on the job up and wants a decision right now. How do you handle it? Very simple. You say, Joe, I'm happy to give you a decision. In fact, I'll give you one right now if you want it, but I have to tell you, if you force me to a decision now, the answer has to be no. Tomorrow, after I've had a chance to talk to my scheduling people, the answer might be yes. So why don't you wait until tomorrow and see what happens? Fair enough. As a contractor, the use of higher authority is very critical to you when you're power negotiating. Always maintain your own. Always try to remove the other person's resort to higher authority. The next gambit we'll talk about is how to handle an impasse. However long you've been a contractor, it's very easy to confuse an impasse with a deadlock. You're a sub, and the general calls you in the middle of the night and says, Joe, be on site at 6 in the morning, or I'll get someone who will. And there's no way you can do that. Or they say to you, I'd love to do business with you, but you charge too much. I've got 3 other bids here that are way below what you're asking. And your firm policy is that you won't participate in bid shopping. Or they're yelling at you, I don't want to talk about it. Rip it all out and replace it, or the next person you hear from will be my attorney. All of these may sound like deadlocks to the inexperienced negotiator, but to the power negotiator, they're only impasses. And there's a very easy gambit that you can use whenever an impasse is reached. It's called the set-aside gambit. It was used very effectively by the American negotiators right after the 1973 Arab-Israeli War. We went to the Israelis and said, please at least sit down and talk to the Egyptians, because if you don't, somebody's going to start World War III around here. And they threw us what might easily be perceived as a deadlock, the killer in the negotiations. They said, well, we might be prepared to talk to them, but we want you to understand up front there's one thing that is absolutely non-negotiable. We will never, ever withdraw from the Sinai Desert. We took it during the 1967 war, and that's where our oil wells are. We'll never, ever withdraw from the Sinai. Have you ever had a general present something that forcefully with you? We might talk about doing business with you, but we would absolutely never, ever go along with these payment terms. If that's what you want, forget it. You get paid when we get paid. If you can live with that, we'll talk. With the Israelis, we were smart enough to use the set-aside gambit. It's very, very effective. You'll be amazed how this would resolve what appeared to be major issues when you're negotiating with people. We said, that's fine. We understand exactly how you feel about the Sinai. Now, we also understood, although we didn't reveal it to them, that the Egyptians were just as adamant about getting the Sinai back as the Israelis were about not relinquishing it. But we said, "We understand exactly how you feel about the Sinai. That's where your oil fields are. You took it during the 67 war," and so on. "But look, let's just set that issue aside and get together and talk about some of the other issues that are important to you." It's exactly the same gambit that you would use if you were talking to a general about a project and they said to you, "We might be interested in talking to you, but we have to have this job underway by the first of the month. If you can't move that quickly, let's not waste time even talking about it." Even if it's virtually impossible for you to move that quickly, you still use the set-aside gambit. "I understand exactly how important that is to you. And let's just set that aside for a minute and talk about the other issues. Tell me about the specs on the job. Is there any requirement to use union labor? What kind of payment terms are we talking about?" And you resolve a lot of the little issues first in order to establish some momentum in the negotiation before leading up to the big issues. As we told you when we talked about win-win power negotiating, don't narrow it down to just one issue. But resolving the little issues first establishes momentum. Inexperienced negotiators always seem to think that you need to resolve the big issues first. Boy, if we can't get together on the biggies like price and terms, why waste a lot of time talking to them about the little issues? Power negotiators understand that those apparently unresolved impasses become a lot more flexible after you've found some agreement on the small issues. So establish that momentum. And as you know, in the Arab-Israeli crisis, we eventually did see the Israelis withdrawing from the Sinai, in spite of the fact that they assured us initially that it was the last thing in the world they would ever do. If you do actually reach a deadlock in the negotiations, the only way to resolve a deadlock is to bring in a third party, someone who will act as a mediator. Some industries, notably the automobile industry, the timeshare industry, and the promotional land industry, use the third party clause all the time. But anyone can use it when negotiating, and it's very, very important. The key issue here is that the third party has to be perceived as reasonably neutral by the other person. You say, "It appears we've reached a deadlock here and I don't know how we're ever going to resolve it. But look, I know a fellow who's a member of BIA or AGC, and he seems to be very good at finding a way past these deadlocks. Why don't we bring him in and see how he feels about it?" Remember that there's a technical difference between a mediator and an arbitrator. When a union goes on strike, if it's a critical union, the federal government will eventually insist that an arbitrator be appointed, a neutral third party. But with an arbitrator, both sides agree up front that they will abide by the decisions of the arbitrator. A mediator doesn't have that kind of power. He simply acts as a catalyst, using his skills to seek acceptance of a solution that both sides will think is reasonable. Attorneys use the third-party mediator route frequently, and they're skilled at bringing in the mediator without the parties to the negotiation even realizing what they've done. I was once involved in negotiation for the sale of one company to another one. As you can imagine, we had two huge teams of attorneys that were working trying to resolve all the difficulties, which were many. After weeks and weeks of negotiating, we appeared to reach what was an absolute deadlock. It was only resolved when one of the attorneys was smart enough to say, "This is obviously going to take a lot more time than I thought. I have to be in court this afternoon, but I'll tell you what. Joe, my partner, will be in after lunch and take my place." So Joe came in after lunch. He was completely new to the situation. Each side had to explain where they were in the negotiations. Joe took great pains to position himself as neutral. He did this by saying to his side, "Are we being fair to them by pushing that point? Maybe we could give a little bit there." That caused the other side to think, "Well, he seems to be much more reasonable than the last guy. Maybe we should listen to him." Having positioned himself as neutral, he was able to find a common ground in the negotiations that got us past the deadlock. So anytime you actually do reach a deadlock in the negotiations, then the thing to do is to bring in a third party who's perceived as reasonably neutral by the other parties. That's what President Carter was able to do at Camp David. It took years and years for the United States to position itself as neutral with Egypt. They always saw us as the enemy and the Soviet Union as their friends. Henry Kissinger saw a remarkable opportunity to change all that, and he jumped at it. He was actually sitting in Anwar el-Sadat's office at a time when Sadat was desperately trying to get the Soviets to clear the Suez Canal, which was shut down with the wrecks of ships sunk during the war. The Soviets were probably very willing to do that, but their bureaucracy was so great that they couldn't move fast enough. Kissinger said, "Would you like us to help you?" Sadat said, "Would you do that?" Kissinger picked up the phone in Sadat's office and called the President Nixon in the White House. Within days, the Sixth Fleet was on its way to the Suez. With this one act, they started the process of positioning us as reasonably neutral between the Israelis and the Egyptians, an act which eventually led to Carter's success at Camp David. So remember that if you reach an impasse in the negotiations, use the set-aside gambit. If you do actually reach a deadlock, look for a third party who can be positioned as neutral. Let's talk about good guy, bad guy. It's one of the best-known negotiating gambits. Charles Dickens wrote about it in his book Great Expectations. You remember in the first chapter, Pip is lost in the fog of the marshes of England, and out from the fog comes a prisoner with chains around his legs. His negotiating problem is to get Pip to go into the village and get a file so that he can remove the chains and bring it back to him. He has to put enough pressure on Pip to go do it, but not put on so much pressure that Pip would get too scared and not return. So he used the good guy, bad guy gambit. He said, "Pip, you know, I really like you, and I would never, ever do anything to harm you. But I have this friend out in the fog, this bad guy, and there's just no telling what he might do if you don't help me." It's a very effective way of putting pressure on people without confrontation. I'm sure you've seen good guy, bad guy used in movies. A suspect is brought into a police station for interrogation, and the first detective to interrogate him is a rough, tough, mean-looking guy. He threatens the suspect with all kinds of things that they're going to do to him. Then he's mysteriously called away to take a phone call, and the second detective, who's brought in to look after the prisoner while the first detective is away, is the warmest, nicest guy in the entire world. He sits down and makes friends with the prisoner. He gives him a cigarette and he says, "Listen, kid, it's really not as bad as all that. I've kind of taken a liking to you. I know the ropes around here. Why don't you let me see what I can do for you with them?" And it's a real temptation to think that the good guy's on your side when, of course, he really isn't. Then the good guy would go ahead and close on what salespeople call the minor point close. "All I think the detectives really need to know," he says, "is where did you buy the gun? What they really want to know is where did you hide the body?" But starting out with a minor point and then working up from there works very well, doesn't it? It's the equipment salesperson that says to you, "If you did invest in this truck, would you get the blue or the gray? Would you want the heavy-duty shocks or the standard?" Little decisions lead up to big ones. It's the real estate salesperson who says, "If you did invest in this home, where would you put the furniture in the living room? Or which of these bedrooms would be the nursery for your new baby?" Little decisions lead up to big decisions. Good guy, bad guy has worked on you an awful lot more than you might believe. Look out for it any time you're dealing with two people. A salesperson and a sales manager. Business partners, husband and wife. Chances are you'll see it being used on you in one form or another. For example, you might have made an appointment to meet with the vice president in charge of construction at a development company. When you get over there to make your proposal, you find to your surprise that the president of the company wants to sit in and listen in on what you have to say. Everything appears to be going along fine. You feel you're going to accomplish all of your objectives in the negotiations, and then the president starts getting irritated. Finally, he says to his vice president, "Look, I don't think these people are interested in making a serious proposal to us. I'm sorry, I've got things to do," and then storms out of the room. This shakes you up if you're not used to negotiating. Then the vice president says, "Wow, sometimes he gets that way, but I'd like to see us using you, and I think we can still work this out. If you could just be a little bit more flexible on your price, I'm sure we can still put it together." And if you don't realize what they're doing to you, you'll hear yourself saying something like, "What do you think he'd go along with?" And pretty soon you'll have the vice president negotiating for you, and he's not even on your side. If you think I'm exaggerating on this one, consider this. Haven't we all, at one time or another, said to a salesperson, "What do you think you could get your sales manager to go along with?" as if the salesperson is on our side, not on theirs. So look out for it. The counter tactic to good guy, bad guy is, first of all, just identify the gambit. It's so well known that people are embarrassed when they get caught using it. Oh, you say, smiling, come on, you guys aren't going to play good guy, bad guy with me, are you? Come on, sit down, let's work this thing out. And their embarrassment will cause them to retreat from the position. The second thing you could do is go over their heads to a possible supervisor. For example, if you're dealing with an equipment salesperson and his sales manager, you might call the owner of the distributorship and say, your salespeople were playing good guy, bad guy with me. You don't approve of that kind of thing, do you? And the third thing you can do to counter good guy, bad guy is to say to the good guy, look, I understand what you two are doing to me, and I want you to know that from now on, anything that he says, I'm going to attribute to you also. So now you've got two bad guys to deal with, and it diffuses the gambit. This gambit is very, very effective, even when everybody knows what's going on. It's what Carter and Reagan got the hostages out of Iran with, wasn't it? You remember that? Carter lost the election. He was very anxious to do something about the Iranian hostage situation before he left the White House. So he started playing good guy, bad guy with the Ayatollah. He started saying to them, if I were you, I'd settle this thing with me. Don't take a chance on this team coming into office in January. My goodness, have you taken a look at these guys? The president's a former cowboy actor. The vice president's former head of the CIA. The secretary of state is Alexander Haig. These guys are crazier than Englishmen. There's no telling what they might do. And Reagan, playing along with it, said, hey, if I were you, I'd settle with Carter. He's a nice guy. You're definitely not going to like what I'll have to say about it when I get into the White House. And sure enough, we saw the hostages being released on the morning of Reagan's inauguration. A clear indication that these gambits work, even when the other people know what you're doing. In fact, when you're power negotiating with other power negotiators who understand all of these gambits, it becomes more fun. It's like playing chess with a person of equal skill, rather than with someone whom you can easily outsmart. Our next power gambit is to never jump at the first offer. Now, why should you never jump at the first offer? We talked about this initially in session one, didn't we? Anytime you say yes to the first offer, people automatically think, I could have done better. The second thought they have is, something must be wrong here. And the third reaction is, here's an opportunity to nibble, to get a little bit extra that I didn't expect to ask for if they're so anxious to accept this particular offer. So never say yes to the first offer. Let's say that you're a contractor meeting with an owner's representative to negotiate a lump sum contract. You've proposed $1 million, but in your mind you're thinking, this is going to be tough. I've got a little slack in this proposal, but not much. They're probably going to come back at around $900,000, and it's going to be a tough battle all the way. But to your surprise, they come back at $975,000, well within your negotiating range. And you're so pleased that it wasn't worse that you make the mistake of saying yes too quickly, automatically triggering these three thoughts in the owner's rep's mind. One, we could have done better. And next time we will. In business negotiations, very often when the other side loses, they don't say to you, well, we lost that one, didn't we? No. They think, we left some money on the table on this one, but we'll get it back the next time we do business with them. They won't get to us again. Secondly, something's wrong here. We didn't expect them to go along with $975 that easily. These guys must really be in trouble. We better get another contractor to give us a second bid before we go ahead. And three, there's some slack in this bid. Let's nibble for some extras. So be careful that you're not saying yes too quickly. Before I understood things like this, I thought I was a pretty good negotiator, because I always came away from negotiations feeling that I'd done a pretty good job, even if I didn't get everything I'd gone in for. When I understood things like this, I realized that I'd just been dealing with people who were better negotiators than me, who knew how to set it up to make me feel that I had won in the negotiations. Let me tell you a story that happened to me that clearly illustrates why, even in the most extreme circumstances, you should never say yes too quickly. As president of a real estate company, I was approached by an owner of a magazine who wanted to sell me a half page of advertising, for which he asked $2,000. I thought that was a pretty good price. It was a well-distributed magazine. It was in a field that was exactly what we needed, and I thought $2,000 was quite reasonable. However, I wanted to practice my negotiating, so I used several of these gambits on him and finally got all the way down to the unbelievable price of $800. I couldn't believe that he'd come down to less than half the price that seemed fair to me. So the more I thought about how much I got him down, the more I thought, if I got him down this far, I wonder how low I could get him to go. So I used higher authority on him. I said, $800 sounds fair to me, but I do just have to run it by my board of directors. I'll get back to you in a couple of days with the final okay. A couple of days later, I called him up and said, I'm really embarrassed about this. I took it to the board of directors. I felt sure that I could sell it to them, but they just won't go along with it. They did come back with a counterproposal, but it's so low that I'm embarrassed to even tell you about it. He said to me, tell me what they suggested. I said, well, they did authorize me to go ahead at $500. I'll take it, he said right away. And I felt cheated. Even though I got him down from $2,000 to $500, just because of the way he quickly said yes to the proposal, I felt I could have done better. I'm frequently asked at my power negotiating seminars, wouldn't you be embarrassed if one day somebody was in the audience who was involved in one of those gambit stories that you tell? And you know, that actually did happen to me. I was speaking to the annual convention of the California Association of Realtors, over 2,000 people meeting in San Diego, California, and I told the story that I've just told you, the story of the magazine salesperson. As I finished the seminar, I saw this person coming up from the back of the room, and it was the same magazine salesperson. And I thought, oh boy, am I in for a blistering now. But you know, he came up to me, shook my hand, and said, Roger, I want to thank you so much for telling me about that. I had no idea. Just think of the business I must have lost over the years because I didn't realize I was doing that. So never ever jump at the first offer. Always go through the process of negotiating to make the other person feel that they won, not you. And you know, I thought this was a 100% rule until I heard about a student of mine by the name of Tim Rush. Tim Rush managed a real estate office in Southern California. He called and he said, Roger, I was driving down Hollywood Boulevard the other night listening to your cassette tapes in my car. I stopped at a gas station to use the restroom. And as I came back out to my car, somebody stuck a gun in my ribs and said, okay, buddy, give me your wallet. Well, I'd just been listening to your cassette tape, so I said, here's what I'm prepared to do. I'll give you the cash, but let me keep the wallet and the credit cards, fair enough? And the guy said, buddy, you didn't listen to me, did you? Give me the wallet. Yes, sir. There are times when you don't negotiate, but it's almost a 100% rule. So power negotiators know that they should always go through the process of negotiating, however good the first offer. Can we pause for a minute?
Yeah. Okay.
This is the feel, felt, found formula. Whatever people say to you in response to your proposal, don't argue with them. Always agree with them. You see, power negotiators know that arguing always forces people to defend their position. It creates a confrontational negotiation. Agreeing with them diffuses the competitive spirit. Let's say that you walk onto a car lot and you're interested in a Mercedes automobile. You tell the salesperson the model you like and he walks you over to the car and you say, but this is a diesel, isn't it? I don't want a diesel. I've heard about all the problems they have with diesels. He wouldn't argue with you. He wouldn't say, well, obviously you don't know very much about automobiles, because if you did, you'd know that diesels do this and this and this and this, and it's clearly the best thing for you to do. A smart person would say instead, hey, I understand exactly how you feel about diesels. You do? Oh, sure, just about everybody I've ever met has felt exactly the same way as you do right now about diesels when I first show one to them. That's feel and felt. Now let's see how the found comes in. However, he says, when we've taken a closer look at it and really examined the needs of the buyer, we've always found that it really is the best way to go. The Mercedes factory gives out awards when cars pass the 250,000, 500,000, and 1,000,000 mile mark, and the cars that get the top two awards are always diesels. They're less expensive to operate, and they last longer. don't argue with people. A lot of contractors, without thinking, do that. When people object to a proposal, they try to argue them out of it, and that's not the thing to do because it creates a confrontational negotiation. The thing to do is to agree and then gradually turn it around with the feel, felt, found formula. Let's say that the owner's rep on a hotel project is objecting to the high cost of the top-of-the-line carpet padding. You say, "I understand exactly how you feel about that. Many other people have felt exactly the same way. Why put a lot of money into something that no one will ever see?" But you know what we've always found? We've found it's one of the smartest things you can do. When people walk into a hotel lobby, they react based on three things: what they see, what they feel, what they hear. There's no question that your lobby has tremendous visual appeal, but top quality padding substantially affects the way people feel about your hotel. When they sink into carpet, a sense of luxury overcomes them. And when you hit them with the room rate, it doesn't sound nearly as bad. And quality padding tends to absorb sound better too, which relaxes people. It's kind of like Sir Winston Churchill from my old country. He was a grand old man. He had one big weakness: he loved to drink. His biggest antagonist was Lady Astor, who was in favor of prohibition in England. One day Lady Astor came up to him and said, "Winston, you are disgusting. You are drunk." Now, he was a good enough power negotiator not to argue with that. He agreed, and then he turned it around. He said, "Lady Astor, you're absolutely right. I am drunk. But you're ugly. And in the morning, I shall be sober." Isn't that terrible? But he knew the value of agreeing and then turning it around. I love those Lady Astor stories. I'm sure you've heard the one where she said to him, "Winston, if I were married to you, I would poison your tea." He looked at her and he said, "Lady Astor, if I were married to you, I should drink it." And I think my favorite one is when she invited him to her country estate for dinner. They were serving chicken and she said, "Winston, what would you like?" And he said, "I think I'll have a piece of that breast." And she said, "Now really, Winston, that's rather crude, don't you think? In this house, we simply refer to it as white meat or dark meat." The next day, he bought her a corsage, and he sent it to her with a note attached that said, "Lady Astor, you would do me great honor if you would pin this to your white meat." But the point is, always agree with people, and then turn it around. It's feel, felt, found. Power negotiators understand when you're negotiating with people, dumb is smart and smart is dumb. You're better off not to act too sophisticated a manner because this breeds competition. If you act a little dumb with people, they want to help you. Remember the old Columbo television series, The Detective in the Raincoat? How smart he was to act dumb. He did it so effectively that he even had the murderers trying to help him solve the cases. You don't have to act that dumb, but there are ways that you can communicate that you're not a competitive threat to people with whom you're dealing. The developer's attorney might say to you, "There are some ambiguities in this contract, don't you think?" And you say, "Ambiguities? Now, wait a minute, I've heard that word before, but I'm not quite sure what it means. Would you explain it to me?" And they think, "Oh boy, what a klutz we've got here." Don't overdo this. In session 7, we'll talk about expertise power and how important that is to power negotiating. We don't want you to come across as a complete klutz, because if we do, they won't trust us to do the job right. But perhaps you're an electrical sub negotiating a change order with a general, and you say, "Would you go over those figures for me one more time? I really know electrical wiring, but I've never been good on the money side of it. Would you show me how it works one more time?" And instead of wanting to compete with you, they want to help you. Of course, the worst thing you could do is say, "I've been studying Roger Dawson's home study course on power negotiating, so I know all there is to know about negotiating." Immediately they would think, "So you think you're a good negotiator, huh? Well, just watch me, and you've created a lot of unnecessary competition." It's a rule in dealing with people that the value of services always appears to diminish rapidly after those services have been performed. This is called the call-go principle. Power negotiators know that any time you make a concession in the negotiations, you should ask for a reciprocal concession right away. The favor that you did somebody now loses value very, very quickly. 2 hours from now, the value of the favor you did has diminished rapidly. Real estate salespeople are very familiar with the call-go principle, because when the seller of a property has a problem with it, and the real estate salesperson offers to solve that problem for 6%, it doesn't sound like an awful lot of money. The minute they have performed the service by finding the buyer, then all of a sudden that 6% starts to sound like a tremendous amount of money. 6%, the seller is saying, for what? What did they do? All they did was put it in the multiple listing service. They did an awful lot more than that to market the property, but remember the principle. The value of services always appears to diminish rapidly after those services have been performed. I'm sure you've experienced that, haven't you? A general has called you. They're in a state of panic because they forgot to get you to move up a start work date. Now their entire project shuts down unless you can work miracles and be there first thing in the morning. Sound familiar? So you work through the night, rescheduling jobs all over the place, and the general just loves you for it. So you say, happy to do it for you, Joe. But since I did this for you, how about letting me take first look at that shopping center project that you've got coming online next month? And he says, love to do it for you. Be in my office Monday morning at 10, and we'll go over it. And you think to yourself, boy, have I got this one made. Does he owe me? But Monday morning rolls around, and he's just as hard to negotiate with as ever. And what went wrong? The call-go principle came into play. The value of services always appears to diminish rapidly after those services have been performed. For the same reason, if you're on a consulting basis, you always negotiate your fee up front, not afterwards. Plumbers know this, don't they? They know that the time to negotiate with you is before they do the work, not after. I had a plumber out to the house. He said, Mr. Dawson, I know what the problem is. I can fix it for you. It'll cost you $150. I said, fine, go ahead. You know how long it took him to do the work? 5 minutes. I said, no, wait a minute. You're going to charge me $150 for 5 minutes work? I'm a nationally known speaker, and I don't make that kind of money. And he said, well, I didn't make that kind of money either when I was a nationally known speaker. If there's one thing that I can impress upon you that will make you a 10 times better power negotiator, it's this. Learn to develop walk-away power. Of course, the number one survival principle for contractors is just that, isn't it? Learn to walk away from the jobs that are going to lose you money. The fastest way to get out of the contracting business is to lack the courage to turn down those marginally profitable jobs. And when you start in business, that's hard to do, isn't it? In your desire to get things going, you forget to factor in the cost of your time and the time of any family members who are helping you. And you forget to include an adequate return on investment on the capital that you've got invested in the company. And you forget the cost of reserve for taxes and for equipment depreciation. But as you grow, you learn that these are legitimate costs of doing business and have to be added to the cost of each job. And from there, you add your markup. But being prepared to walk away from the negotiations is a powerful negotiating gambit. The danger is that there's a mental point that you pass when you're no longer prepared to walk away. There's a point you reach in the negotiations when you start thinking, I'm going to get this job. I'm going to get the best price and the best terms I possibly can, but I have to nail this one down. And the minute you pass that point, whether you're buying equipment or dealing with an owner or a developer or a general, the minute you pass the point when you say, I'm prepared to walk away from this, you lose in the negotiations. So be sure you don't pass that point. There's no such thing as a contract you have to have at any price. There's no such thing as an investment acquisition that you can't live without. There's no such thing as an employee that you can't live without either. And the minute you pass the point when you think there is, you've lost in the negotiations. At seminars, when somebody comes up to me and tells me that they made a mistake in negotiations, this is always a part of the problem. They passed the point where they were prepared to walk away. Somewhere down the line in relating the story, they'll say to me, I made up my mind that I was going to get it. And that's the turning point in the negotiations, the point at which they lost. Always be prepared to walk away. Let me tell you about an incident that occurred to me that may be helpful to you as a contractor, because it will illustrate how to use this gambit to give you power in the negotiations. I owned a couple of properties in Long Beach, California. That's about 50 miles from where I live. I wasn't that familiar with the marketplace, and I was having trouble finding a good real estate agent to handle it for me. Finally, I heard about an agent by the name of Walter Sanford, who seemed to be very aggressive in the way he went about business. He seemed to be the kind of person that I would want to have representing me in the sale of this property. I called him up and said, "I've got a couple of properties very close to your real estate office. I'd like you to list them for me." And his response was, "I might be prepared to represent you. When can you come to my office so that we can talk about it?" I liked that. He clearly was familiar with power negotiating. Number one, he was prepared to walk away from the listing. He didn't take the typical real estate attitude of, "Boy, if it's two listings, I'll drop everything and come right now." He said, "I might be prepared to represent you." Secondly, he knew that you should always try to negotiate in your own territory. He was a lot better off if he could talk me into coming into his office than if he came to my home to discuss it. And third, he was starting the process of getting me to follow instructions. If you can get people to start doing what you ask them to do, even if it's a very small thing, you start to take command of the relationship. And a momentum builds, which ends with, "Bear down, the fourth copy's yours." So I made an appointment for 3 or 4 days later, went to his office, and met with him. In the meanwhile, he had checked out the properties and prepared a couple of information folders with his suggested listing prices. But these prices were way below what I had hoped the properties were worth. But by this point, I developed a confidence in him, and I thought, well, he does know the territory a lot better than I do. Either I trust him or I don't. I'll go along with his proposed listing prices. And then he said to me, "Mr. Dawson, you do understand that I won't work with anything less than a 9-month listing, don't you?" And I said, "Now, wait a minute. 9 months when we've never worked together before? I don't think I'm prepared to take my property off the market for 9 months." And what he did was terribly bright. He stood up, he closed the folders that he'd been consulting, he reached across the desk with his hand extended, and he said, "Mr. Dawson, I'm terribly sorry, but I guess we won't be doing business together after all." He was prepared to walk away from the listings if he couldn't get what he wanted. Where did that put me? Now I was in a position of having to negotiate with him to get him to accept the listings. But of course, he had no idea with whom he was dealing. I was able to get him all the way down to 6 months on those listings, which is what he wanted in the first place, of course. And I admired that. I'll teach you later why you should always ask for more than you expect to get, so you set up a climate where the other person can win in the negotiations. But the key issue here is communicate to the other side that you're prepared to walk away. And what will typically happen for you is what happens when you're down in the stores in Mexico. When you're prepared to walk out of the store, they come racing out after you. My daughter bought a car a while back. She went down to the BMW dealer and test drove a used BMW. And fell in love with the car, and they knew it. Then she came back and wanted me to go back down with her to renegotiate a better price. Tough situation, right? On the way down there, I said, "Julia, are you prepared to come home tonight without the car?" And she said, "No, I'm not. I want it. So I told her, "Julia, you might as well get your checkbook out and give them what they're asking, because you've already set yourself up to lose in the negotiations. We've got to be prepared to walk away." We walked out of the showroom twice in the 2 hours that we spent negotiating and got the car for $2,000 less than she was prepared to pay for it. How much money was she making while she was negotiating, bearing in mind that I waived my normal fee? She was making $1,000 an hour. We'd all go to work for $1,000 an hour, wouldn't we? You can't make money faster than you can when you're negotiating. So you become a power negotiator when you learn to project to the other side that you're prepared to walk away from the job if you can't get what you want. As a contractor, be sure that you've built enough desire before you threaten to walk away. Obviously, if they don't particularly want you for the job yet, and you threaten to walk away, you're going to find yourself standing on the sidewalk saying, "What happened?" Contractors should consider marketing as a 4-step process. 1, prospecting, looking for people who want to do business with you. 2, qualifying, can they afford to do business with you? 3, desire building, making them want you for the job above everybody else. And 4, closing, getting the decision. And walking away is a stage 4 gambit. After you build desire and you're going for the decision, In a heavy situation where there's a big job at stake or a lot of money on the table over a change order, for example, don't threaten to walk away without the protection of good guy, bad guy. Don't do it alone. You always have a good guy left behind. Then if you threaten to walk away and they don't say, hey, wait a minute, where are you going? Come on back, we can still put this together. If they don't say that, then you still have the good guy left behind who can say, look, he's just upset right now. I think we can still put this together if you can be a little bit more flexible in your pricing. Power negotiators know that learning to communicate subtly to the other side that you're prepared to walk away is the most powerful gambit of them all.
As always, we welcome your feedback on each month's presentation. Feel free to give us a call with your comments, or if you prefer, you may fax or email our office. As a reminder, our 3-day Basic Business Bootcamp continues to take the industry by storm. For more information on ProfitMax and or our bootcamp, simply call or write Grandy & Associates. The Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month is produced and distributed by Grandy & Associates. If we can be of service to you, give us a call on our toll-free line at 1-800-432-7963. Until next month, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.